The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Xochitl Gonzalez's debut novel, Olga Dies Dreaming, tells a tale of family secrets, a gentrifying Brooklyn neighborhood, and romance set against the backdrop of the most devastating hurricane in Puerto Rican history. Winner of the Brooklyn Public Library Book Prize in Fiction and the New York City Book Award, it was named a best book of 2022 by The Washington Post, NPR, The New York Times, and Time Magazine. Her nonfiction writing has appeared in Vogue and The Cut, and her commentary writing for The Atlantic was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. She joins us this evening with her new book, Anita DeMonte Laughs Last. Please welcome Xochitl Gonzalez to the Free Library.
Hi, it's so nice to see you all. Thank you for coming out. It's so nice to be in Philly. And I thought tonight, since I'm not in conversation, I actually thought I'd just sort of walk you through a little bit of the genesis of the book and then read a little bit as things go on. You know, I had the idea for this book in the summer of 2020. And it was like I was in the midst of editing Olga, and weirdly also working on trying to make the TV adaptation of Olga happen. So it was a strange time, and it was deep, deep COVID. Like deep, deep COVID. And I had a notes call with the network, and my producing partner texted me afterwards. It was like, art and commerce, what can you do? And it was so weird. I think so many weird things probably happened to people during COVID. Like we just had these like weird memories, and I had this memory of one of my art history textbooks, and I suddenly was like, oh my gosh. I was like, I found myself literally transported back to Brown at that point, like 21 years earlier, and remembered all of the time I spent in class where I didn't ever study very few women, I think like two women maybe, and literally, I think it was literally like Berthe Morisot, and Berthe Morisot and the woman who paints the lily interiors that look like vaginas. I go, whose name I'm blanking on now. I'm a bad art history student suddenly. But I really, like, I was a little bit shocked, frankly, when I thought about it in hindsight. And I don't know if it was that I suddenly was wondering about all the legacy that I had missed out on, but I found myself thinking about, as I was walking around, you know, desperately trying to get some free air out of my mask, thinking about, like, Ana Mendieta, who was a Cuban-American artist that I kind of discovered by happenstance my senior year, towards the end of my senior year. A friend knew, you know, the minority community at Brown in the 90s was so small that a friend gave me as a graduation present, like, kind of like a Caribbean art book, and I was like, literally, it was as if somebody had said, I felt at once stupid and then mad when I thought about it. Like, I was like, Caribbean art? Like, it was like, I don't know. Like, it had been 4 years, you know. At Brown, you can take as many classes of whatever you want because you have no, like, requirements. And so I had been in that slide room, the dark kind of art history classroom, class after class after class, and I was like, Caribbean art? And I was like, it was like I had this revelation. I would tell everybody that I knew, like a weird evangelist. And then one of my art professors who, you know, was a young, now it's, and one of the things I try to talk about in this book a little bit is like, you know, when you're really young, you think people that are like my age now are like ancient, like, right? Like, it's like, and they were, she was a little bit young, and she's like, you know, you should look up Ana Mendieta. And looking up somebody then, pre-Google, really meant like a whole thing, you know? And then once you put in that whole thing, you're like, okay, like, I'm invested now, like, I'm deeply invested. And so I found myself in the summer of 2020 ruminating about Adam and Dieta and ruminating about my art history class and thinking, how would I be more confident if I had gotten this when I was in school? Like, and in part of the curriculum, if like, how would I have thought about things like differently? And I texted, you know, maybe 20 minutes later, I texted my producing partner back and I was like, I think I have the idea for my next book. Like, right? And then I didn't have time to work on it for like 2 more years. And 2 years later, you know, I was like, well, I'm not going to write about Adam and Dieta. It's going to be a new character. You know, I'm going to fictionalize this person and I'm going to fictionalize this kind of alternative history, I guess, of myself. But the first, you know, the idea was always like, this murdered artist sort of seeks vengeance in the afterlife for what happened while impacting the life of this college art history student, you know, who has not been taught any of this person's work. And when I actually sat down to write it, like 2 years later, I had been so knocked around by Hollywood, to be completely honest, that I think Anita DeMonte has, like, you know, the borrowed biography of Adam and Dieta, which felt very important to keep for a lot of reasons that I'll get into, but like, and then it had so much of my own frustrations and experiences as an artist, you know. But when I sat down to write it, I will say this, I changed it at some point from third person to first person, but the beginning was almost always the same. So I'm just gonna read a little bit of the beginning. If it weren't, this is how the whole book starts. So Anita in 1985. If it weren't for what happened later, everyone would have forgotten that night entirely. It wasn't like the 70s, you know? Nights when you never knew what could happen, what to expect. No, by 1985, the parties in New York were all the same. One night, one party, bleeding into the next. Nothing specific or momentous enough to press itself into your memory. The guests, the conversations, the taste of the fucking wine on your lips, all more or less the same. Especially Tilly's parties. Formulaic, interchangeable. Some felt that's what made them work, but for me, it depressed me. That impossible distinction of the passage of time. The drinks were always set in her claustrophobic galley kitchen to force intimacy. The food, what little there was, wasp hate feeding people, set atop the piano in the center of her massive loft. The poor young artist hovering while it lasted. The music just loud enough to soften silences, but too muted to inspire true revelry. Over the years, Philip Glass was replaced with Sun Ra, the hot new artist aging into establishment figures or disappearing altogether, replaced by other younger faces. All the big museum people were always invited, naturally. Tilly enjoyed the thirst shared between those two groups in particular, the haves dangling their opportunities tantalizingly before the have-nots. It created a great friction in the room. She remarked once, after years where I was the only brown speck in attendance, lately there'd been a noted effort to populate the guest list with more third world artists. The sudden concern for diversity coinciding with the Met hiring their first black senior curator. I'm not being cynical, just honest. It would be embarrassing to invite Rory to the party and have her see only white people there. But outside of that, in all the years of these fêtes, very little had changed. Except, I suppose, for me. If you were in New York and in the art world, you did not refuse an invitation from Tilly Barber. And for whatever reason, that night was particularly crowded. Bodies and conversations packed close enough to create a hum. I remember feeling a restless excitement when I arrived, the kind that you feel when you're giddy from holding a secret, one with wings that flap furiously in your palm, knowing that any moment now, that secret could fly up, out into the world, its motion changing fortunes and futures, oceans or even lifetimes away. And I, the only one containing it, such a power. Giancarlo Recantor, that he was telling me a story. I was listening, but not. He always came back from Rome with the longest stories. I was distracted, knowing that at any moment he'd arrive, Jack Martin, my husband. And then, as if I willed it by simply glaring in the doorway, he did. And so that sort of sets up kind of all the critical people in Anita's world, primarily her husband, Jack Martin, who will torment her, and she will torment to some extent, but also this character of Tilly. And I think a lot of what I was trying to kind of look at here was like the strange dynamics of power that exist, like, you know, in not just the art world, but I think in the world in general. And so, you know, I ended up it weaves in with this other storyline, which I'll get into, but Raquel's story, which is a lot about her relationship with a kind of another artist. She's an art history student. She's in a relationship with an artist with a young man named Nick, and she has another kind of power dynamic. Tilly is Jack's dealer, and she's very powerful in the art world. And she hosts these parties where everyone needs to be. And she doesn't particularly like Anita's work, and so this has been like the kind of like thing hanging over Anita's resentments of Tilly, but not unfounded, right? Like, it's like Tilly actually does have some power in the world, and Anita's very ambitious. And then when we meet Raquel, before we actually meet her love interest, we meet sort of the parallel person in her life that kind of has that same sway, and it's her professor, John Temple. And she's, so Raquel is, a first-gen kind of low-income student at Brown. I think of Raquel as, like, my alternative self. She's more shy than I am. Like, I said that once in a way. I was like, she's quieter than I am. And someone's like, you clearly think that's an insult. And it was really not at all. I think she was quieter than I was in college in a way where I thought, as soon as I worked in a museum once, I was like, you don't belong here. I was like, you are so, I'm wearing a toucan shirt, everyone. I was like, I do not belong in a museum. But I thought Raquel would, I was like, I think she needs to be like the version of you with just enough biography in common that she would. But her kind of metaphorical Tilly, the person that she feels she needs this support of, or this like kind of approval of, is her professor John Temple. And so, we end Anita's chapter, like we meet Anita and we kind of meet all these people, and she's having a fight with her husband. And then we cut to 1998, and this is how we end up meeting Raquel. So Raquel Toro walked into Professor Temple's light-filled office and for the first time did not feel herself shrink. She'd woken up that morning and admittedly, after a night of two-for-one cosmos with Mavette downtown, looked like shit. But she felt proud, ready to meet the day, and John Temple unintimidated, neither by the mountains of books, catalogs, academic texts, tomes of criticism that he not only owned but had at least in part authored, nor by the exhibition posters lining the walls featuring shows that he had mounted or had a major hand in. Today, Raquel walked in feeling worthy, not just of the company of his brilliance, but of her very place in this school. Before arriving at Brown, Raquel hadn't spent much time pondering what an Ivy League college would be like. She'd been too grateful for the opportunity to have expectations. But during her sophomore year, when John Temple called Raquel to his office hours for the first time, and she saw him behind his vast desk, she knew that this was it. This was what the Ivy League was all about. Wool blazers and expensive but understated watches, salt and pepper beards stroked for effect while holding court for enraptured students. The Ivy League was John Temple, whose name held no meaning for the average or even above average person, but whose work had the power to shape institutions, markets, and culture in its most erudite of forms. He was a man of great importance in the world. And in such proximity to that, despite the brilliantly drawn constellations he commended her on during his seminars or her insightful yet accessible papers that he praised her for, she had always felt deeply insignificant until today. I got the fellowship, she said, noting the confidence in her own voice. I'm going to be a curatorial fellow in the contemporary art department this summer. John Temple's handsome face broke into a smile, revealing his perfect teeth. He pushed the Ames chair away from his desk to fully face her. Brava, Raquel, brava, I had no doubt. She felt the flush coming up her neck and tried to contain her grin in a way that would seem less obviously delighted by his approval. Your recommendation put it over the top. Nonsense, it was a solid application across the board. It seems small, but the RISD Museum is a jewel box. Oh, I'm very aware. Three of the fellows are from Harvard and Yale. Professor Temple looked impressed. Then she remembered he had gone to Yale. Competitive field, even better, he smiled again, leaning in towards Raquel. A long way from selling sandwiches at the Met, huh? He said, pleased. She felt herself, her equalness, evaporate. Quick and sudden, a red flush of shame replaced it, the kind that morphed fast into anger. Raquel simpered, fought hard to suppress the what the fuck does that mean that he would have gotten had he come at her with this bullshit back home. She reminded herself that he couldn't have meant it as an insult, even if it felt that way. This was not Brooklyn, this was Brown. Here was a place of measured tones and intellectual rivalries. Here was not a place where necks were rolled, nor teeth sucked, nor fucks flung around willy-nilly. Here was not, he just reminded her, a place for girls who worked concessions at the Met, which wasn't even factually correct. He hadn't even remembered her story right. I think one of the things that I had, like, some fun with when thinking about this was sort of, like, the ways in which age changes the way you deal with things, you know, and there's a few instances like where you see Anita kind of with this Tilly character. For both of them, these characters end up being these sort of cuddles outside of the romantic relationships. So they're kind of the thrust of the book, but like this is sort of how you see them almost outside of themselves, like in some funny way. And it was almost like I really loved seeing the way like a 36-year-old woman deals with an adversary or somebody they perceive as an adversary versus the way a 20-year-old does. And it was so hard. That was like writing Raquel was the hardest part of this book because it was so hard to take away. You know, I was probably 40, and now I'm 40. I just had to do math earlier. I'm going to be 47 this year. I was really, you know, I was 44, 45 when I was working on it for the most part. And I had to take out like literally my own college diaries to remember the way in which I saw things. And I couldn't, oh, by the way, what intriguing writing and yet terrible narrative structure I had. I would tell a story, like I'd be like, and then I'd describe a remarkably traumatic incident over like 6 pages and then just stop writing and then pick up like 3 months later and never revisit the story again. You're like, but what, oops, oh, there's a lip. I was told about that lip and I forgot. I was like, what happened to that story? So, you know, but I think it was really interesting to kind of strip that away and see how that confidence grows in a person, but in a woman in particular. Like, how do we develop confidence? Like, right? Like, and that was one of the main things that was so fascinating. And sometimes, you know, she ends up, so Raquel ends up poisoned slightly, but not poisoned, like she ends up in this great, it starts out as great and then it isn't that great relationship and it keeps going and it gets further and further complicated. But it gives her like a bizarre new level of confidence because I think that she feels in the beginning that John Temple's like her only path into a future. And she ends up meeting this like old, you know, slightly older, affluent artist. And he takes this deep interest in her and is introducing her to his family and they're very connected in the art world. And suddenly John Temple isn't her only person. And she's able to sort of like see him. Like, I don't know. It's really like, it's so interesting. It's like I hadn't even thought about it so much actually consciously. Like I think our unconscious does so much work in a book, but like she quite literally ends up going back to him and she's like, goes to his office right before she's having her campus dance, which is a big deal. And she's going with this guy and she's meeting his family. She's feeling great about herself. Right. Like, and she's like, stops by his office hours. She's like, John Temple's office was a mess. In fact, Raquel realized John Temple was a bit of a mess. His typical collegiate sartorial flair replaced with a Bad Brains t-shirt and some khakis. This t-shirt, she decided, was the most edgy thing about him. Around her were boxes of books and papers, some that looked old enough to have traveled with John Temple from his olden college days. Apologies, he said, and Raquel noticed his stubble was at least 2 days longer than usual. Like I mentioned, I'm moving, so trying to reorganize some of this stuff. Yeah, no worries, she replied. I moved yesterday. It's exhausting. Now add 25 extra years of shit you've collected and a divorce, and you'll get where I'm coming from. Oh my God, she thought to herself. John Temple is the sad divorced guy. She had not known he was married. He had, however, always seemed a bit sad. I'm disorganized, he said now, going through some piles on his desk before pulling out a manila envelope, which he handed to Raquel, but I'm getting it together. She stifled a giggle because in that moment he looked like a gray-haired version of Nick or countless other boys on campus. She wondered if perhaps the difference between youth and middle age was not simply having gray hair or stubble, but wearing the pretense of having it together. Anyway, I think like I started to realize as I've been like kind of walking around and touring the book, like how much her own growth is in learning how to deal with an adult like, right, or a perceived authority figure. And there was some sort of joy, I think, actually, in giving her strength, like, that, you know, comes in a lot of ways through Anita. And Anita, on the other hand, has a far more... Most of Anita's coming of age in this book is actually her undoing all of the little bit of politeness that she had. She's really what in Mexican Spanish you'd call a chingona, you know? Like, it's like she's really something. And, like, if you dare her, she's going to do more, you know? And so... And in some way, she ends up becoming a little bit of what I would say a godmother of sorts, a spiritual godmother to Raquel. And so I think, I don't know why I became so fixated on talking to you all about secondary characters, but I actually think that they give so much insight into who these characters are. So after we realize that Anita's dead, which we discover in the first chapter, and that she's narrating from the beyond, she kind of walks you through the relationship, the ill-fated relationship that led us here. And she starts out with describing to you the beginning of the end, right? Like, because that's all that matters to her. And it starts out as her husband has a retrospective at this museum in Berkeley. And instead of taking this art fellowship, she decides that she's going to follow him. And he's like, he promises that they're going to have all this time in the Redwoods, and they're going to do art together, and he's going to support her. And then, of course, like, she's basically like his escort at every little cocktail party that he gets invited to every single night that they're there. And she realizes on the night of the opening that she's, you know, she's Cuban. She'd come on Peter Pan, which was like, you know, this bizarre CIA Catholic Church, like, double operative, where they went to Cuba after the revolution and convinced all of these families to send their kids to America. And so she ended up in Iowa, like, in an orphanage. And this is actually factually true of Ana Mendieta and something that I kept for Anita de Monte. And so suddenly, when she's in Berkeley and they're meeting all these new people, she realizes how much her husband has her telling the story, because it kind of makes him interesting by association. And it's like this painful story for her, you know, like, and so she's like, what's going on? And so she sort of storms off a little bit. She does just enough of the dance and she storms off. And then she's in the ladies' room, and Tilly, who's his dealer, who had had the party, who'd rejected her art years before, comes in. The door to the restroom opened and it was Tilly carrying a drink. Hi there, she said. I thought you might need this. Thank you. I set it on the counter while I reapplied my lipstick. You look very fetching, Anita. She sounded sincere. I was about to thank her when she added, that dress was made for you. Is that a Dior? Halston, I said flatly. My antenna went up. Tilly knows a Halston from a fucking Dior. Jack has a woman at Bergdorf who helps him pick things. He's mentioned it. Tilly was what I learned wealthy white people called a handsome woman. Tall and lanky, but dressed in a way that was elegant. She was brilliant, absolutely the greatest champion her artist could have behind them, but ruthless. She was never a fan of mine. Well, at least not my work. She told me in her own polite way to my face, but as far as I'm concerned, to dislike my work is to dislike me. Unlike my husband, I don't separate the two. This is a big night for Jack, Tilly said, and he wanted you here by his side, wanted to be sure you looked as gorgeous as possible, for you to be the one he introduced people to. Tilly, I picked up my purse and took a sip of my drink, Jack has a lot of big nights. I know, because they take up a lot of mine. I'm trying to be a friend here, Anita. And what's your friendly advice? Just shut up and let him make my family history a prop for his one-man show? My advice is this: choose. Lots of women come to New York to become things. Actresses, artists, singers, and they don't all have the talent to make it. But they don't all have your luck, either. Excuse me, I said. I heard that you saw my facialist at Helena Rubinstein, Tilly replied. And it was true. She was excellent. The personal shopper, those gorgeous earrings, getting to travel around the world with someone who finds you gorgeous and fascinating and doesn't mind at all that you're a bit abrasive, finds it challenging even. And what the fuck are you trying to say, Tilly? Lots of girls try to make it big, doing something really hard and fail. There is no shame in that, but most of them don't meet and seduce the most successful artist of a generation. Seduce, I said with a laugh, but I felt the vibrato in my voice, not the quavering of tears, but of anger. I didn't move to New York to be a kept woman. I came to do my work. I was much shorter than Tilly, and she looked down upon me now with a patronizing gaze. I wanted to slap her. Anita, she said, exasperated, the only reason you can't sit back and enjoy it, the only reason why you bristle at how you're introduced and how Jack talks about your family or your history is because you're so intently caught up in being taken seriously as an artist. And I'm just telling you that you don't have to be. Jack doesn't care. Her words, said with her clipped boarding school enunciation, clawed and scratched me like a feral cat, cloaked in the coo of gallery talk, the politeness of museum powered a room, but vicious. Made worse because I knew this wasn't conjecture. He had told her as much. He told her about the shopper and the facialist, and that he didn't give a fuck if I was an artist or a housewife. But I care that I'm an artist, I said. A smile appeared on her face, one that I remembered from when she looked at my portfolio. It was a smile doused in pity. I bit my tongue, resisted the urge, because the truth of the matter is she was just the messenger, an intervention based on what I could tell were many, many heartfelt conversations. I wanted to say, you fucking Buddha, wait till you see what I do with my career now. I will not stop until you can't walk into a museum anywhere in this world without seeing a fucking Anita de Monte. I won't stop until they refer to Jack as Anita de Monte's boyfriend. Wait till I fucking show you. But instead I said, well, thank you for that advice. And I walked out of the bathroom, slammed the rest of my drink, and got another. So, to tell you the type of person that Anita is, they then go to a dinner. And on the way to the dinner, Jack says, did you have a nice talk with Tilly? And she said, oh, yes, of course I did. And then they're all seated, and European style, you know, husbands don't get to sit with wives, boyfriends or girlfriends or otherwise. And so she says, in the meantime, Giancarlo, the only person remotely interested in me, started asking questions. Anita, are you still doing the works, the blood that I had seen in Art in America? Oh, no, darling, I'm not doing anything at all. But what do you mean, Giancarlo replied. You haven't started working, have you? Stopped working, have you? Oh, no, I think I'm about to embark on a period of tremendous growth. Rebecca from the museum decided to give a toast. They began serving the entrees. I had ordered the tartare, Giancarlo the mussels. Everyone was settling into their meals when I decided that I wasn't going to fall in line. Not that night, and frankly, not ever. I clinked my glasses a few times, quieted the room. Excuse me, I said in my best Ricky Ricardo. I would like to make a toast to the man of the night, Señor Jack Martin. Everyone around the table now had their eyes on me, genuine expressions of curiosity on their faces. Jack, though, wasn't looking at me. His eyes bore into his tartare instead. You know what? I said to the crowd, I think you all can hear me so good. I am weak, pequeñosita. Let me make this nice and easy. I stood up on the chair, felt my stomach drop getting off the ground. But when I looked at Tilly's face of absolute horror from five place settings down, I decided it was worth it just for a minute or two. If you don't know me, I'm Anita Tropicana and I'm young. Jack's novia cubana. You all know Jack is a brilliant artist, but not many people know Jack is an humanitarian muy grande. America see me from Castro, y Jack see me from the life of a starving artist. Get down from there, you fucking bitch. He gritted his teeth from across the table. It was more than a whisper, but not his full voice. I was too frightened to look down at him. I looked straight ahead and put a smile on my face and kept going. Jack said, you don't need to make art, Anita. I make art good enough for both of us. You just sit there and look pretty. I could sense him moving, even though I couldn't look down. I could hear his footsteps, heavy and quick, close and then far and then close again. And he walked around the table. I just kept going. I just say, thank you. I want to work so hard anyway. It's so nice you all celebrate Jack tonight. I screamed despite myself at the shock of being yanked off the chair. He threw me over his shoulders as he cursed me quietly in my ears, calling me a bitch and a cunt and a fucking nightmare. Adios, everybody, adios, I called out to the crowd as he marched us out the door. He walked out to the car that the museum had sent, opened the back door, threw me into the back seat, and told the driver to take me to the fucking house. I was on my way to the airport before he even got home, and I never, ever put Jack in front of myself again. And I just wanted to, like, talk about part of why I wanted to, why fiction's amazing. I think part of my fixation on Anna Mendieta had always been that, like, we just didn't know. You know, like, we didn't know what she could have done. And we didn't know, you know, once somebody becomes a victim, we're so true crime obsessed right now, right? We're so so true crime obsessed right now. And like everybody becomes nice. I saw this hilarious TikTok and this woman was just like, if someone kidnaps me, tell them that I the truth and that I was a bitch. Like, and I was like, that's hilarious because everybody becomes really nice and really lovely and they get flat, right? Like we're all these like really intriguing people. I mean, everybody's really complicated and interesting, but I find women particularly complicated and interesting. And like, and I just thought with fiction, I have this ability to not let the last word be that she went out of a window, and that the last word can be how she feels about that. And you know, I don't know, I've been talking a lot. I've been in conversation. You all are getting the One Woman Show, which is kind of fun to me. It's fun for me. I don't know if it's fun for you. It's fun for me. Like, but I think one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about, because, you know, you end up reading these little weird reviews and stuff, and people are like, oh, you know, and then it goes into magical realism. And I'm like, it's not that I don't believe in magical realism or that I don't like magical realism. I think that I don't like the idea that it's considered something in my literary toolbox and like I'm going to do satire or I'm going to do magical realism or like it's like more like the woman is dead. Why should she be living in the confines of our world? That seems ridiculous. I'd love to, I don't want to think that that's what happens. Like I really prefer thinking that reality can be more magical, especially when you're on the other side of something. So, you know, is it a spoiler? I don't know. It's been in a lot of things. She discovers upon death that if she's mad enough or like vibrating enough, she can turn into a bat and come into the physical realm. And so she discovers that Jack and Tilly are trying to kind of suppress her legacy. You know, she's dead and she's mad. Oh, of course she's freaking mad. She's really ambitious. She's on the rise. She's up to so many things. She's about to embark on this whole new chapter in her life, which I won't even get into, but like she, and then she's dead and she's annoyed. And so she's really annoyed. Like she's really, really annoyed. And so she overhears that her husband's asked Tilly to call in some favors, you know, to kind of silence her work. And then she did it. Puta madre, did his bidding. A handmaid of the devil, a woman bewitched. She knew it was wrong and still, she made call after call to curators and journalists, first suggesting gently that perhaps this was a bad time for the show, for the art world in general. Of course, no one wants Anita to be recognized for her work more than I do, but is this the best timing? A little bit of distance would allow the art world to heal. Oh, and I know she said these things because I was there. I was sitting right on her desk in her office, propped up on the countertop of that fucking claustrophobic galley kitchen, sitting on her piano bench, listening to it all, and I got there not because Jack called me, but because of her. Her and her seemingly troubled thoughts. I was minding my own business, lying out in Veradero in the sun, when I heard the Sable call. It said her name loud and clear, Tilly, and it came with a wave of upset and sadness and shame and loyalty. Oh, the weight of the loyalty. And I climbed and I climbed and I was in her loft and I heard her make call after call and pour drink after drink after she did so. The museum in Chicago folded right away. Oh, the cowards, the fucking fools. I raged. I had no intention of presenting myself to Tilly, had hoped to simply listen, observe her in this act of moral disgrace. But as soon as I heard the pause, the silence on the other end of the phone when she said, don't you think it might be good to make some space for the art world to heal? Oh, she didn't even need to say Jack's name. Didn't need to twist an arm or be a heavy or anything at all. There was just some silence in which she sipped her drink, and a funny habit she somehow never did in public, scraped the polish off her nails with her teeth, waited, leaned over the counter of her galley kitchen and peered out to the rest of the loft as if looking for something. And then I heard the coward on the other line. Oh, the fucking institutionalist, the pig. Well, our next show is from our collection, so we can slide some things around. And Tilly let out a sigh, not of relief, but that I could feel, I could smell, was of repugnance, of self-disgrace, because she knew what she was doing was wrong. She knew it, but she was straight again, swallowed, and said, Well, it's so wonderful for you to be so considerate. And she said goodbye like the polite wasp she was. She hung up the receiver and I took the tumbler from where she was, the scotch had been, and flung it against the floor. I threw it with such force it shattered. The lead crystal that had probably been in her family for generations destroyed. Destroyed! Like she was trying to destroy my work being in the world. And that bitch didn't miss a beat. Anita, she said. How did she know it was me? How did she know it was fucking me? Her knowing made me angry. She, of all people, shouldn't understand. She who set out to erase me, and I wailed. I don't know why. You cannot understand the stab to my soul this was, this woman who couldn't have helped, who could have helped me time and again, being my undoing even in death, and it stung. Stung worse because she knew it was wrong. She didn't want to do it. She knew that even if she had thrown me out the window, even if she hated me, I didn't deserve to be erased. And her complicity made me all the more vexed. She picked up the phone to call the curator from Philadelphia next, and I hung up the receiver. I saw her, those watery blue eyes, go wide in surprise and then unwide in recognition. And she saw the lever depress and then come up again, heard the line go from bring, bring, bring to be, 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 be. She tried again, and I hung up again. She tried again, and I hung up again. In my frustration, I thought of my saber tree, found myself back in its thick crown, descended until I was able to find a bough sturdy enough for me. I wrapped my ankles around a branch and allowed myself to hang upside down so that my hair hung long, 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 like Rapunzel's braid below me. I crossed my arms, soon to be wings over my chest, and closed my eyes and breathed in and out, out and in. I tried to wipe Tilly and Jack and my sister and my art out of my mind just for a moment, just long enough to feel free. And when I did, when I was fearless, I allowed myself to drop, felt the kiss of cool wind around me as I spread my arms, heard the flap of air catching them, and suddenly I was swoop, flying through the open window of Tilly's loft, soaring over the same place that I danced that night I died. Swoop, circling Tilly on the phone in the living room now, dropping the receiver as she noticed I was in the room. Swoop, down toward this imperturbable bitch who somehow managed to politely end her call. I'll have to ring you back, Philip, but I hope you'll consider a postponement. Oh, but I knew it wouldn't be a postponement. I knew this was going to be the end. I knew. And in that moment, I realized it was not thoughts. It was not memories. It was not my mother's tears or my niece or nephew's displaying my photograph that made me powerful, that made me vibrant. It was my art. It was my art out in the world. Because when my art was out in the world, so was I. My energy, my spirit. Swoop. I came in toward the bun on her head and began picking and picking and picking. Anita, she said sternly, Anita, you're upset, but this isn't going to solve anything. Swoop, I went up towards the ceiling, the very high ceiling, and then I dove fast, fast, fast down towards her hands, protecting her hair, sunk my fangs into her bony fingers and thrilled in hearing her scream, hovered over her to watch the blood come, then dove in again, not at her plain face or her hands like Jack, but at her perfectly neat blouse, at her unwrinkled skirt, at what remained of her hair. She loved to be perfect. And I was going to make her a mess. I was going to make her a mess for having no heart. Oh, she was heartless. Anita, how did she know it was me? Jack had not told her. I was certain. How did she know it was me? Anita, it's done. It's done. All the calls were made. If they didn't say yes tonight, they will say yes in the next few days. It's done. I flew into the kitchen and wheeled more glasses onto the floor, onto the walls. I flew over the piano and flapped my wings against photographs of her and Jack at Miss Porter's and her at Radcliffe and her being perfect, being perfect, being perfect. I scattered them all to the floors with the power of my wings. I flew over her armchair, her velvet sofa, her elegant Turkish rugs, and I let myself shit guano all over them. Stenchy, acidic feces all over her house. I flew over her head and I shat over that too. It isn't right, Anita, but it just is, she said, and I could feel the sorrow. I could feel the regret, but regret within action is just a swallowed apology. I know you're mad, but we never got along, but you have to understand, you are dead and Jack is alive. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I couldn't believe she could truly be so clueless, so naive, as though the issue here was me not knowing that I was dead. I knew I was dead. Of course I was dead. And though I couldn't talk, and though whatever I said would probably be too high-pitched for her to hear, even if by some miracle Tilly could speak back, I had to say it to her. I had to let her know. Swoop. I hovered right in her face, right up close as I could get, and I looked into her watery blue eyes with my glassy brown ones that I hoped she would remember, and I screamed, but I want to be alive. I want to be alive. I want to be alive. Anyway, I don't know. I guess, like, in some weird way, the whole thing was kind of a way to reconcile a lot of, okay, cool, a lot of stuff that had just been hovering in my heart. And I think, I don't know, it was funny. Then I was like, probably almost done with the first draft, and I was really struggling about the epigraph. You know, like, I like them. I like epigraphs. I don't know if people like, people probably don't even read the epigraphs half the time, but like, I am obsessed with them. And I really was such an art history nerd. I have almost all my art history books. I have the book that I remembered that day. Like, I was like, I went back, like, you know, my stuff was like in storage. It was weird COVID times. But like, I have that book, like, some, it's in my office now. And then I found my freshman year art history textbook, like that intro, it was intro to art history. And I found this quote, and I think I'm going to read this, and then I can take questions. But this is from Arthur F. Janssen's preface to the fifth edition of History of Art, Volume 2, H. N. Abrams, 1994. Why, indeed, should one not include artists who embody very different sensibilities from that of the European and the mainstream? There is, in principle, no reason to exclude them whatsoever. However, I have decided to limit this edition to Western art. I have taken a stand about what art I think is most significant that not all readers will agree with, since it favors universality over ethnocentricity. Just again, I did not take history of Western art. I took history of art. As the title of the book indicates, History of Art, Volume 2. So second time, chance to correct the mistakes, decided not to do it. And I don't know, I think I've thought a lot. You know, it's funny, I think that Raquel starts out more meek than me, and then she actually ends up being, she also ends up being a bit of a chingona in a way that I was definitely not at that age. But it's because of Anita. And I think, you know, there's so much talk in the news these days about curriculum and what we're learning and all these things. And I didn't set out to write this because of that, but I think it's much more that I wondered what part of a person gains confidence by seeing themselves reflected in what is told as good, you know, what is told as worthy of study. And I don't know, that sort of, romance is a big part of this book, but I guess like the driving force in some funny way was tied part and parcel, right? Like what we'll tolerate because we feel worthy is all kind of fundamentally linked. So,
Early in your remarks, you mentioned that the unconscious does a lot of work.
Oh my God, so much work, yeah.
Could you just elaborate on that a little?
Yeah, like, so, you know, the two stories run in parallel, and I don't think, like, for instance, I don't think I really had even noticed how their interactions with, like, the Tilly and the Professor Temple kind of mirror each other in a rhythm. You know, like, it's like, and I didn't, you know, when I was working on Olga, I was very much like, I would map out like chapter, like I'd map out maybe four chapters at a time until I kind of got to the end. And then more or less the way that book came out was the way that it was. This, I say, is like a very long film, and I had to shoot like 20 extra days before I could cut it down. You know, like there was a lot on the cutting room floor. But I don't know, I thought of each story pretty independently. Like I wasn't like, oh, I need to mirror that. Like I think, and so less than even the relationships, because some of that felt just normal. Like that's like what would happen in a weird relationship when you're that age and the power dynamics are off, like whatever. But it was more the way in which they engage and change, right, through these other characters. Or, you know, the way that you end up at party. Like, you know, I think when you're like, there's a strange phase in, I can say in heteronormative relationships where you're like really delighted to be shown off somewhere. And then at some point that flips, right? And like, and that ended up kind of mirroring itself. Like, I think a lot of the mirroring was actually quite unconscious. And in a way that, you know, I think probably reinforced the other, but it wasn't like I set out and was like, well, now they each have to have a moment like this, right? Like, and that was kind of funny that way. Yeah, and I think, you know, I'd say the other part is really Anita's character ended up having so much, like, I think that she ended up carrying a lot of my own like frustrations in a way that until I went back, I didn't quite realize. And honestly, even Raquel, I didn't intend for Raquel and I to have quite as much in common. Like it was more like once I walked her through a day, you know, so the setup is like it's 1998 and it's a very small minority community and like the it's pretty segregated, like the school itself is pretty segregated. But she wants to do art history and she's the only one in her department of like the students of color that's doing art history. And so she just ends up alone a lot. And I think once I was walking her through this sort of, and she's first gen and her mom, like another thing that kind of keeps happening, Anita's very independent, but Raquel's parents, or Raquel's mom and her sister are very much in her life. And you can tell that she's too exhausted to even try to explain herself to them. And like, and I hadn't even known that until, about myself, until I saw that in Raquel, if that makes sense. And that was totally unconscious. Like, I was like, well, I have to have her family involved. And then it was like, when I realized that she wouldn't tell them so many things, it was like, oh, this makes sense why that felt like an isolating time, if that makes sense. So some of it, the subconscious stuff was also just sort of therapeutic. You know, great, yeah, you're like, oh, that all fits together.
Hi, one of the things that I really loved about Olga was the impact that geography has on identity, whether it's mainland versus island or Manhattan versus the outer boroughs. And you see a bit of that in Anita.
Yeah.
Or rather strike that in Raquel.
Yeah.
And of the same kind of like wrestling with Puerto Rican identity.
Yeah.
I wonder how you investigated like the Cuban identity and the diaspora.
I am so happy to talk about this. Keep going. Yeah.
Yeah. how you wrestled with exploring that identity.
Yeah.
And making sure that there wasn't this kind of monolithic like Latinx experience.
Yeah.
And if you had like sensitivity readers, only because I've seen that you're of Puerto Rican and Mexican descent. And so how did you get at the Cuban and then Cuban-American experience?
Yeah. Well, I'll talk about how I did it, and then I will explain why I didn't have sensitivity readers. I was originally, like, there was a version of this where you could have just said, oh, Ana Mendieta was, you know, this Latina artist. You could say, Ana Mendieta is a Latina artist who was potentially murdered by her husband, right? And then forgotten for a period of time and then, you know, rediscovered over time. And then I ended up doing my MFA in Iowa. But in reality, what I know is that she was Cuban American, that she came on Peter Pan, and she was sent to an orphanage in Iowa, and then a foster home, and then an orphanage. And so I ended up doing my MFA in Iowa. And there was one thing of knowing that. And then there was a really different thing of walking around Iowa City where she did her MFA, knowing that she was sent maybe, you know, an hour away in rural Iowa 50-ish years before. And I couldn't, it changed the way I saw her early work completely. Like in the sense of like, oh my God, like I knew when I was, I taught one semester and my Latino students were like telling me horrific tales of racism they'd encountered in Iowa. And then I thought, oh my God, imagine that 50 years before. And so I felt what drew me to keeping sort of that aspect of the biography was, in a funny way, one of the things about Olga, but also about my family's history is like, I always say nobody in my family chose to come to America. America kind of came to them. And I was attracted to this weirdness about her story where she was a very reluctant American. You know, like she was like, I did not want to come here and fuck you. And like, you're lucky I'm here. Like, and like, you know, like, and she was a very unusual pro-Castro Cuban for most of her life, right? And I complicate that with Anita a little bit more because once I went back to Cuba, I'd gone once on my own, but I went for a research trip and I went and I follow the path that what happened was then Ana Mendieta in 1980, I think she was sent in like 64. And then in 1980, she finally gets an opportunity to go back like on a diplomacy trip where like the government was sending artists to Cuba. And I found somebody that had been a tour guide on that trip and tracked them down. And I had them walk me through the same itinerary that she took. And then I was like, I have to keep the land art, because suddenly when I smelled the soil of Cuba, where she did the sculptures in Jaruco, I was like, there was a spiritual process that was happening when she was doing this art in Iowa. And then that felt it needed to be a part of Anita De Monte's story. Like, I don't know what Anna Mendieta felt about that, but I know what Anita De Monte felt about that. And I think I didn't, actually, it's funny because I had a couple of, I shouldn't say I didn't have sensitivity readers. I just had readers, okay? Like, I had readers. And actually, a lot of Latinas, a couple of Cubanas, like, you know, somebody, they were like, she doesn't seem Latina enough because she's not so into her family. And I was like, fuck you. She hates her family. They sent her to America. She's really pissed. Like, not that she hates them. She likes her sister, you know, like her and her sister were stuck there together. But like, so I didn't want a sensitivity reader because I felt I was creating one character whose journey was very specific, you know, and like, and there was no, you know, that term third world artist, like, it's funny, it mirrors, that isn't a purposeful mirroring, but like, that was literally the term that was used in the 70s for this body of work of artists, but it was also the term that was used for the Minority Student Center at Brown until maybe like 6 years ago, great, like 7 years ago, the Third World Center. And so, and I didn't know that was whack until I told one of my girlfriends that went to Howard that, and like, I remember you looked at me, Sharon, and were like, that's crazy. But you know, like, I think, I think that my feeling was, then it's this very intimate person's journey. And I think what I was not trying to do, Olga was a symbol of the people of Puerto Rico. Anita De Monte is a woman who's from Cuba. And it's an individual journey. And I wasn't meaning to, like, that said, I had a really great time in Miami talking to a bunch of Cubans about this. And I had a great time hearing from people that had come from Peter Pan and their thoughts, like, you know, very loosely about the book. So I think that it was really in the opposite way of, you know, I did the research. But in the opposite way, I was not trying to make her stand for, you know, I really, this was one person. Yeah.
Yes. I will. Okay. To be completely honest, after going around for 2 years saying Olga Dies Dreaming, I really had really wanted to try to find a one-word title for this book. And my very, 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 very astute editor said, it sounds like a nonfiction book. I was going to title it Legacies. And then literally, like, 3 months later, there was like, I saw an announcement about a nonfiction book that was going to come out the same year titled Legacies. So I was like, oh, that was a really good call. But we decided to lean into the name, like, and I wanted Laughs Last because I felt like in the beginning, you kind of know that she's going to meet some sort of, you know, untimely end. But I didn't want you to worry that it's a story of tragedy. Like, I wanted you to feel there's a hope of agency. And I think, if anything, one of the things that I'm always sort of trying to do is showcase, you know, Latina women of color's agency and resilience. And so I think I didn't want, I wanted everybody to hold themselves in comfort, knowing, just keep going along for the ride. Like, I'm letting you know it's going to be fine for her. Yeah.
I love your fiction, and I love your nonfiction, and I was wondering if you could talk about what you have to do differently for each, and also how they inform each other for you as a writer.
Yeah, the second part's an easier, I write for the Atlantic. The second part's easier, and how they inform. I think I work through a lot of themes, so like, I had been writing this, and I was like deep into Raquel's like kind of novel stuff, and you know, like deep into Raquel's college experience, and then the Atlantic asked me, you know, to write about Quiet for the magazine, because I'd written some newsletter pieces that were shorter, you know, about like silence in class, and I think like that, for instance, I knew immediately how to find my way. Like, I was like, oh, I'm gonna come into Quiet, like I'm gonna come in through my experience going to college. Right, like in that summer before and then getting there, because it was so on my mind because of the book.
And then a lot of themes about like feminism and beauty. You know, I do a ton of research actually. I don't know. I think part of my desire to work with the near past, you know, the near historical, is just for so many decades there was so little Latin fiction. That it's really easy to keep pretending that we're a new group and we've been here for centuries. We've been here as long as America. Like, right? And so, like, I feel like it's a, you know, to me, it's important to kind of look in the, particularly in the near past. And so, you know, I remember I ordered all these beauty magazines from the 90s to just remember how people talked and, like, you know, what we were ingesting and the zeitgeist. And I wrote a bunch of pieces about kind of feminism and beauty standards because of that. And I think what it helps me to do, and I see the difference between, you know, Olga to some extent and this, is like it helps it feel a little bit more diffuse, the themes, like the themes that are not character related, in the sense that I kind of felt like I scratched that itch and I don't need to get it out here. The process is like, I mean, so different. Like I wrote my piece about affirmative action on my iPhone notes, you know, like I didn't write this on my iPhone notes. Like, no, like, you know, like I feel like I am like a hollowed out human being working on a novel, but like, and I take time to try to do it and see my friends and stuff like on the weekends, but like, I'm, you know, I grind really long days. Like I have to be super immersed, but like articles, you know, I mean, I do my research and I do my interviews and, you know, like all that stuff. But like when that requires it, but like it's I don't want to disparage it by calling it a it's an awesome job. But that's like my day job. And then I take these little breaks to do the fiction work because that feels like it requires this emotional work that character work. It's character work. You know, it's like some fucked up version of method acting with like, you know, it's just not. So, yeah, it's just definitely like different and maybe in a lot more immersive. But I think it's helped a lot. Like I know what the next book is. And like, it's not on purpose. It's just like coincidentally, like I've seen a couple of pieces that I ended up coming up or that made themselves feel interesting to me. Like the next book set in like 07. Ish, and like I'd already started the opening and it opens with a Cassie song and then, you know, everything kind of came out about Puffy and like, and visiting it again, like I had this like super emotional reaction, but that's not appropriate for my book. Does that make, like, I can't bring that to, but now I've figured it out and then it's there in a different way, you know what I mean? I don't know, it's, it diffuses, so I find it quite helpful. Yeah. Thank you. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Marlena works at Flatiron, and that was a great... the next book is kind of a gender-swapped retelling of The Great Gatsby, but set in Fort Greene before the financial crisis and the summer of the Democratic primary between Hillary and Obama. So I'm, like, looking forward to it, and I'm going to be hard at work grinding this summer and I can't wait. And in that sense, like this one was really heavy for me to write, and like this one, the other one, it's heavy in some its own ways, but like it's got some fun stuff in it. My friends from my 20s, my Muppet Baby years, are very nervous. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.